Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week we'll be talking with James Lee Burke, whose Dave Robichaud novels are a grand canvas of life and trouble in southern Louisiana. James Lee Burke is one of the great men of Louisiana letters. He was born in Houston, grew up on the Texas-Louisiana coast, and lives today in Missoula, Montana. He's received so many honors. The Mystery Writers of America have named him a Grand Master in recognition of his fabulous Dave Robichaud series, and he received the Louisiana Writer Award from the Louisiana Book Festival. Today, we'll be talking about the 19th novel in the Dave Robichaud series, Creole Bell. It's also his 31st book. Jim, welcome to The Reading Life.
Well, thanks for having me on your show, Susan.
I'm so happy to talk to you. I have to say, I was really depressed after The Glass Rainbow. You had me mourning Dave, and yet he rises again.
Well, yeah, this book is a continuation of The Glass Rainbow. Two books make one.
Did you have that in mind when you wrote it?
Yeah, I guess I did. Yeah, you know, and this new one's a long book. It was 875 pages in manuscript.
Wow. You set this novel around the BP oil spill, linking that, of course, to other things. When that was happening, did you know immediately you would be writing about that?
I knew in some form or another. It was one of the worst environmental disasters in the country's history, but the book never specifies that the blowout, the oil well blowout, is necessarily the one we associate with BP. Not that I was protecting these guys, but in my view, this is a problem that has always been with us. I mean, in my earliest memories, I remember oil in the Gulf, oil being everywhere. It's just everywhere. And I think larger public is not aware of the downside of the petrochemical industry. And the book's not meant to be an attack on the petrochemical industry, but it is meant to be an honest portrayal of the price we have to pay for cheap gasoline.
Right.
That's one of the themes. But the damage done in Louisiana is enormous. It's just mind-boggling. I've written about this for 50 years. To me, BP's an old story.
Right.
Different names, different accents, but it's the same story. Good heavens.
And you write about it with such clarity because you're really able to bring home that human cost. When Dave remembers what happened to his father, that's an incredibly powerful scene there.
Yeah, Dave's father died in a blowout. And he points out that the media bought into the term oil spill. And so from the jump, the story, in effect, did not convey, I think, adequately what actually occurred. A blowout is not an oil spill. An oil spill is limited. That indicates a breach in, say, the hull of a ship, something that has limitations in terms of the damage it can actually do. An oil well blowout is like tapping into hell itself. And Dave's father died in one. I based that explosion on a Texaco rig that blew out in 1964, and it killed, I think, about 18 or 22 men. But in both instances, the rig hit a pay sand early, and the blowout preventer was not in place. The alarm system was defective.
Now, you've worked in the oil business. You were a landman for Sinclair, right?
Yeah, I was a landman for Sinclair, and I worked a little bit in what people call the oil patch. I was a pipeliner. My father was a natural gas engineer and died on the job. He worked 30 years in oil and natural gas. In fact, he invented a separator of sludge and salt water that was quite an innovation in oil production, oil drilling. My mother worked all of her life for an independent oil producer. So it would be disingenuous of me to say, well, the oil business is made up of villainous people. There's an enormous difference between the people on the ground who actually do the work and the guys who run the petrochemical business. Mr. Cheney is not the exception. He's the rule, brother.
There's that laugh, I know.
They do business with baseball bats, and they'll be the first to tell you that.
Yeah.
They will tell you they're guys who, in effect, have got one charge, and that is to produce oil and natural gas to make large profits for their corporations and their shareholders. But it goes beyond that. In effect, I think we're seeing an end to nationalism, but a nation's boundaries are being, in effect, rescinded and replaced by corporate entities.
Oh, yeah.
New kind of nationalism. But it's driven by corporations, not by the nationalistic tendencies. They go back to the 16th century.
But in terms of character, one of the things I want to talk about is that the women in this novel really, they have it for me. It's so interesting the way the torch is passing to these daughters, from Dave to Alifair, from Cleet Purcell, his good friend, to his daughter Gretchen. That's an amazing duo you've got going there.
Yeah, well, thank you. They're great characters. Alifair Robichaud is a wonderful character. And she's an attorney, but also a Stanford law graduate, but she is now publishing her second novel in the book. And we meet Cleet Purcell's daughter, who was born out of wedlock. And she's a great character. Gretchen Horowitz is her name. And she's heck on wheels.
She is. She is heck on wheels. I've always thought it's so much fun that you have Alifair in the books and Alifair in your life, too.
Well, that said, our youngest daughter is Alifair Burke, and she's a novelist and a Stanford Law graduate. She graduated at the top of Stanford Law, and she has a degree in psychology from Reed College. So she and the fictional Alifair have many things in common.
Well, I love Alifair Burke. She and I are Facebook friends, so I always love seeing what she's up to, you know.
Yeah.
Now, the boundary you've written about before, you've always toyed with this boundary between the real and the supernatural, and that's so important in this book. And a lot of his otherworldly observations come to Dave through music. And I think, you know, in some ways, the way the past haunts him, it's never been quite so elegant and so melodic as it is in this book.
Well, thanks very much. You know, Louisiana is a musical place, and most American music has its origins right down in the Delta. And anyone who grew up in Louisiana shares that heritage. We grew up surrounded by music. You could get on the streetcar on Canal and go uptown, and you'd hear music all the way across the city. It would never be interrupted. You know, marching bands. There were bands on the roofs of the hotels back in the 1950s, I think on the Jung or the Roosevelt. And the Quarter, of course, was filled with music. And it never stopped. That's it. It was 24 hours a day. It didn't stop.
Well, no wonder it haunts us then. It's still out there somewhere.
You remember Sharky Banana's Dream Room on Bourbon Street?
I've seen film from that, but I don't actually remember it, but yes.
Well, Sharky was a 1930s orchestra leader. He had a swing band, and then he opened a club, and he used to bring great musicians to his place. And in fact, I saw Johnny Scat Davis sing there one time. Johnny Scat Davis wrote Praise the Lord and Pass the Ammunition. Did you know on VJ Day, I mean, New Orleans went crazy, you know, when the Japanese surrendered? Strippers came out of the bars on Bourbon Street, walked up Canal and took their clothes off in the middle of the day. The whole town went nuts.
Of course.
You know, came out and played on the sidewalk.
Well, the whole town goes nuts on whatever occasion, you know.
It doesn't need an excuse. people have to have a nervous breakdown to go nuts. People do it as a recreational activity in New Orleans.
So true. Now, when you begin a novel now, I love it that this is your 31st novel. I love it that I can count on them coming along at regular intervals. But I'm curious to know, what do you do for yourself when you begin a novel to raise the bar? Because you continually do that. You set these great challenges for yourself. And I do think every book is better than the last. How is it it stays fresh for you?
Well, I've always believed that the story was not mine, that it was in the unconscious, and I don't know how it gets there. It's just always there, and I wake with it in the morning, and I know I'll be writing it during the day, and I keep a notebook by my bed because I write during the middle of the night sometimes, but I've never understood it, really.
Well, it's a gift, you know. Sometimes you can't understand it. You just have to flow with it, I guess.
Well, I think it is, and I believe every writer knows that it's a gift. It comes from somewhere outside of himself. And those who claim an ownership of the talent they've been given, or they claim, in effect, to have manufactured their own careers, they're about to lose it. That's always been my experience, that mm-hmm. ego is the enemy of all art, and vanity and pride about it. I think every writer, even those who appear to be self-satisfied about their success, will be the first to say it comes from somewhere else.
Well, one of the things that strikes me reading this book, you know, because your books have always been so violent, and this one is no exception, and it's very thrilling and terrifying, and it carries the reader along. But it's almost as if, to me, you've grown in humanity as you've written these books. Humanity is so much your true subject. You know, that dividing line that just separates us, you know, that dividing line between good and evil, and it is so easy to give in to the moment of rage or fury or self-righteousness. And it's, I don't know, this book seems so wise to me in so many ways. Do you feel that when you're writing?
Well, probably if there's any wisdom in the book, again, it comes from some source outside of myself. As Dave Robichaux says of his own experience, he did not acquire much wisdom in his life, and I feel the same way. It's eluded me if it comes with age. I think if we learn anything, it's simply that, like Cassandra, who was cursed with knowledge of the future, an aging person feels that, in effect, he's already seen the show, and he knows what's going to happen next, but he cannot impart that perception to others. That's the great frustration.
Well, I don't know. I feel like I always learn something from these books, something very useful and important.
Okay. You know, speaking of people going crazy, though, the fourth novel in the series, the Dave Robichaux series, is titled A Morning for Flamingos. And in it, we meet a mafiosa character named Tony Cardo. And I think he's one of my best characters. But I based him on a real person, a fellow I knew very well. Guy that was came from a mafia family and was actually born in the house of one of the most infamous mafia dons of our time. But this happened years ago. There's an account in there that's true. This character in the book, Tony Cardo, is a young guy, and he and his buddies are out playing, just walking around on the Tulane campus by the medical school, and they find an ice chest with human arms in it that were being used by the Tulane Medical School. This is a true story. And the severed arms were supposed to be put in the incinerator, and nobody put them in the incinerator. This guy and his buddies put some crushed ice on top of the arms. And at 5 o'clock, they got on the St. Claude streetcar. That's not far from the old cigar factory. And the streetcar was packed with people. And this guy hung these arms from the passenger straps, you know, that people hung onto, hung about 4 or 5 of them in the back of the streetcar before anyone noticed what was happening. The place went crazy. People were screaming. They were leaping, literally, out of the windows. One guy crashed on top of a snowball cart. But anyway, it's one of the best scenes I ever wrote. No one ever mentioned it. All these years. Just life in New Orleans back in the 50s.
Oh, Lord. Now, it would be totally, totally remiss of me not to ask about your family. You belong to one of the great Louisiana writing families. You have more writers in your family than any other family I can imagine.
I think it's probably true. And you know, our daughter, our youngest daughter, you know, Alifair, just published her 7th novel, which is called Don't Tell. Mm-hmm. It's, I think, maybe her best. It just came out. And my first cousin was André Debuse, you know, who's passed away.
Right.
And his son, André Debuse III, is doing just great. I think André Debuse III may be the best writer of prose in the United States. And his last book, titled Townie, is being made into a film. But it's maybe the best autobiographical account ever written by a writer. It's better, in my view, than James Joyce's Portrait of an Artist.
Well, that's high praise and very generous coming from you.
Well, thanks. And, you know, Delaney Michelle, my cousin, is a novelist as well. She's from Baton Rouge. And my cousin, Pam Binning, from New Orleans, is also a writer. She's published several books. Oh, and my cousin, Elizabeth, our best Michelle, our best abuse, also is a novelist. Lordy. I'm trying to think who in our family does not write. Everybody does.
I know there was one year when 5 of you published books, and it was just so amazing to me. I was very, yeah. I was very excited for you. Maybe there really is something in the water, you know?
Well, there are a lot of great artists in Louisiana, musicians and painters and photographers and actors. It's amazing the number of writers who either come from New Orleans or who live there most of their lives. I mean, even Jack Kerouac spent a lot of time there. And, you know, William Burroughs used to have a place underneath the old Huey Long Bridge years ago when there was nothing underneath it. There used to be a flat space there that was overgrown with tropical underbrush. And Burroughs had a cottage there, and Kerouac used to stay there.
I know. People still do anything to come to New Orleans. Any excuse will do. So come on down.
You know, Lillian Hellman grew up on Britannia.
I know. Believe me, I know. Well, Jim, I wish you all the best. I hope you come down for a visit sometime soon.
Oh, we will. We'll be there.
We've been talking with best-selling author James Lee Burke, whose 19th Dave Robichaud novel is Creole Belle, which is being published today, July 17th. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Oh, baby, daddy, take to the bar.
Music has always been important in James Lee Burke's work. You can read his novels through the songs. Here's a little bit of one of the ones that's important in Creole Belle, Beat Me Daddy, Ache to the Bar.
In a little honky-tonky village in Texas, there's a guy who plays the best piano by far. He can play piano in a way you like it, but the kind he plays the best is ache to the bar. When he jams, it's a ball. He's the daddy of them all. The people gather round when he gets on the stand. Then when he plays, he gets a hand. The rhythm he plays puts the cats in a trance. Nobody there bothers to dance. And when he jams with a bass and guitar, they holler, oh, beat me, daddy, head to the bar. A plink, a plank, a plink, plank, plink, plank, plunking on the keys. A rip, a rap, a rip, rap, rip, rap, ripping out with ease. And when he jams with a bass and guitar, they holler, oh, beat me, daddy, head to the bar.
Ready.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Kim Vodica signs Aesthesia Balderdash Wednesday, July 18th at 6 p.m. at Maple Street Bookshop in the New Orleans Healing Center. The Octavia Books Book Club discusses Ann Patchett's State of Wonder, Saturday, July 21st at 10:30 a.m. at Octavia Books. 16 uptown businesses, including Octavia Books, continue their Find Waldo scavenger hunt. You can find that popular children's book character in the red and white striped shirt all over uptown. Pick up an entry card at Octavia Books, search for Waldo, then on August 4th at 2 p.m., bring your card to Octavia Books for Waldo's birthday party. You might win a 6-volume set of Waldo books. STARE, Start the Adventure in Reading, needs volunteers for its summer workdays. Help prepare the materials for next school year, learn more about STARE, exchange ideas about tutoring, and enjoy refreshments. Visit www.starenola.org for more information or call the office at 504-899-0820. And the Reading Life has some news of its own this week. Starting the week of July 23rd, we'll be moving to a new time. Check us out at 1:30 p.m. on Tuesday and noon on Sunday, or anytime online at wwno.org. Major support for The Reading Life is provided by Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org or email us at thereadinglife@wwno.org. Thanks for listening and keep reading.